I would like to introduce our panel. I'll start on the end with Joyce Johnson, who is Special Assistant Program Analysis and Development at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Wildlife and Sport Fishing Fish Restoration Program. She's going to be talking about a study that comes out every 5 years on outdoor sportsman activities like hunting, fishing, and wildlife watching. And I'm really curious about one phrase used in that study called wildlife feeding. I'd like to know what kind of feeding goes on. Do you feed the birds when you watch them?
It is bird.
Okay. I'm not a wildlife watcher, but other than I do watch, but I don't feed. And Matt Cozy Trevor Howard is right next to her. He is a principal research scientist and director of the APNORC Center for Public Affairs Research at the University of Chicago, based in Bethesda, Maryland. And next to him is Matt Cozy, principal research analyst for Security, Energy, and Environmental Department at NORC, also in Bethesda. And they're going to be talking about a study on energy attitudes of Americans that came out a couple of months ago now. Is that right? Yeah. And then we have John Gerlich from Texas Tech. He's a public political science professor. And he's going to be talking about on understanding public opinion on environmental issues for us. So first I'd like to get started with Joyce to give us a rundown of this 2011 national survey. And if you could go ahead. And the way I'm going to do is I'm going to have Joyce and then Matt's going to talk about the APNORC study, and then we're going to hear from John, and then we're going to, and Trevor's here to add some insight to surveys and such, and then we're going to open it up for questions. So if they can just briefly outline these individual studies, and then we'll begin a conversation. So Joyce?
Okay. I'm representing the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Fish and Wildlife Service has been involved in the National Survey of Fishing, Hunting, and Wildlife-Associated Recreation since 1955. It's the longest-running survey of this.
Yeah, get closer. Yeah,
I have to eat the mic. So it's the longest-running survey of this type, and I was going to give you some history on it and then go over some of the numbers for this year. So it really came about in 1953, the precursor of the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies really needed some data upon which to base their facts. They were not collecting that type of data, so in 1955, they began doing these surveys, which I thought was a really, 1953, and they decided to bring in the science base behind the wildlife and sport fish management. So there was a resolution by AFWA, and the survey came in 1955. It's been every 5 years since 1955. I think I counted these up this morning. That makes this the 11th, but it might be the 12th. It was early when I counted. It's done by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, does the coordination of it, but the data collection is done by the Census Bureau, with the exception of 1975 and 1955 when they were done by private contractors. But other than that, it has always been done by the Census Bureau, and even in 55 and 75, it was managed by the Fish and Wildlife Service. The purpose is to gather data at national and state levels on the number of anglers, hunters, and wildlife watchers and other activities, the frequency of their participation, and the economic impact from these participants in these types of recreation-oriented outdoor sports. The more important part, I think, since 1991, they've used the same methodology. So since 1991, 96, 2001, 2006, and now 2011, you can compare the data between years. So they have the same consistent methodology since 1991, and that was an important improvement to this. And for those who are into statistics. It's also a national level data and then goes down to state level data. And sometimes that state level is so important to various agencies and other groups that use this. It compares, as I mentioned, it has the data on the number of anglers, number of hunters, numbers of wildlife watchers, the number of trips and days spent on these various activities, the expenditures by activity, and the activities roughly are freshwater fishing, saltwater fishing, and Great Lakes fishing. And by hunting, it's big game, small game, migratory bird, and other hunting activities. So it's participants total, and then by those smaller categories. For the 2011 survey, it takes an entire year, and that's one of the things about this survey that's special. They, and why in 1991 they changed the methodology. They were going out and saying, prior to that, you know, what did you do last year to get these? And they came upon the idea that people didn't really remember what they spent on a particular trip, etc. So this survey takes a year and follows a group of people for that entire year. They go out in three survey intervals during that time. Most of this is done by telephone. So around 17,000 anglers, 17,000 hunters, and 14,000 wildlife watchers were surveyed for a total of 48,627 individuals were interviewed. I'm sure you wrote that down. And all of them are, it's for 16 years of age and older, and basically that's about the time that you start buying licenses. So this particular survey came out, the national survey, the preliminary is out, and it came out in August. It is subject to change. The final will be out in November. And the state reports, a state overview, came out in September, and it will be available in December. Unfortunately, money is always an issue. This year they will not be printed. They will only be available online. And they are available both at the Fish and Wildlife Service website, the Census Bureau, and the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. And I could give you the web address of all those, but you wouldn't remember it. I wouldn't, but Google gets there, because that's what I do. So the reason this one came as a great wonder is because there's been a downward trend in these activities, except for wildlife watching, since 1991. But this year, that changed, and there were significant increases in both hunting and fishing, and a small increase, 2%, in wildlife watching. And for those in the fish and game business, this was big news, because it has been a downward trend, a significantly downward trend since 1996. So at this moment, according to these, the 33.1 million people over 16, all of these are over 16 years old, 16 and older, 33.1 million fished. They spent about 17 days doing that, and each individual spent $1,262 in that pursuit of that sport. $41.8 billion was spent by fishermen on this type. So you can see it's up there. And that is, participation is up 11% since 2006. 13.7 million hunted. They spent 21 days average doing that, spending almost $2,500 each, and 34.0 billion spent, with participation up 9% for hunting since the last survey. And then the wild number is over 71 million people, wildlife watchers, spent 55 billion and participation up 2%. Nationally, that means that 91.1 million people, or 38% of the American population, 16 and over, are involved in wildlife-related recreation and spent $145 billion doing that. And that is big business. In fact, it's 1% of our gross domestic product. And those are the surprising numbers that people are interested. You sometimes don't think of these as being such economic drivers in small communities especially. And basically this represents an increase of 10% in hunters and anglers from 2006, which comes on the decline since 1991. And to finish up my commercial message is I work for the Wildlife and Sport Fish Restoration Program, and those programs are funded by excise taxes on guns, ammunition, fishing equipment, 10 and 11% taxes. And this is the anniversary year of the Pittman-Robertson Wildlife Restoration Act, and the 1950 was the beginning of the Dingell-Johnson Sport Fish Restoration Act. And I think those are just such economic impetus that brought in the science for this program and conservation. It, most state agencies, that's when they hired their first biologists. These programs have been, in addition to license revenue, which is the state match, 75% of the federal money that they use is how state agencies pay for wildlife conservation in the country. We distribute almost $1 billion in federal excise tax each year, and this is our 75th anniversary, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Joyce. Okay, Matt, do you want to go ahead with yours?
Can everybody hear me? Yeah? Okay. Hi, my name's Matt Cozy. I'm with NORC at the University of Chicago. For those of you who don't know, NORC is an independent nonprofit research organization. We have been conducting social science research in the public interest for over 70 years, and we are nonpartisan and objective in all that we do. And I'm here to talk about a study we did in collaboration with the Associated Press. Trevor here is the director of the AP-NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, and that partnership began in 2011. I think 2011, bringing the objective journalism of the AP to NORC's objective data collection, and its goal is to do exactly what it sounds like: conduct public affairs research. So, this study I'm going to talk about today is called "Energy Issues: How the Public Understands and Acts." So, it's not an environment-based topic per se, but does touch on some environmental concerns. A little bit about it. It was conducted by the AP-NORC Center. It was published in June, and the data were collected from March 29th to April 25th of this year. It's a nationally representative sample. We conducted it in English and Spanish, and there were several stories generated in the Associated Press that got picked up in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, other places. So I'm only going to talk about a couple of the slides, so we have more time for questions and conversation. But one of the things we asked people was, how big a problem is energy to you? And energy ranked overall at about 77% of the population that we surveyed said it was extremely or very important to them. And this was, we didn't see a huge split partisan-wise when it comes to this question. Approximately 80% of Democrats surveyed said it was very or extremely important, and about 76% of Republicans said the same thing. So not a big split. When we asked to rank other priorities, energy was higher than the federal budget deficit in people's priority list, which surprises some. It was also higher as a priority than the environment. And the environment, we saw a large partisan split on whether people thought it was extremely or very important. Specifically, 53% of Republicans said that the environment was extremely or very important, whereas 81% of Democrats surveyed said that this was a very or extremely important issue to them. And you'll see that throughout this, throughout these results, there's a large partisan split that emerges. And like I said, I'm going to skip some of the slides, but something that I think would be interesting to everybody is a question we asked on who Americans trust when it comes to energy savings information. We asked them that basic question: who do you trust to receive information about how to save energy? And the only group that we found a majority either completely or very much trusted were local utility companies, which is in some ways counterintuitive, that the people who are selling you electricity are the people that you most trust about ways to save energy. Consumer groups were the next highest, and this was about 48% completely or very much trusted. Environmental organizations ranked third at about 37%. The U.S. state or local government came in at about 35% completely or very much trusted. So there was a large distrust of information on energy savings from government. Also, retailers and product labels each ranked relatively low, about 31% or 23 or 4% completely or very much trust. So I was personally surprised that local utilities were the most trusted and as highly trusted as they were. And again, there are some slides we have on how Americans view themselves. Do they think that they're doing relatively well at saving energy? 89% of our survey population reported personally doing something to try to save energy in the last year. And the most reported actions were turning off the lights, turning down your thermostat, and then driving less or walking more, things of that nature. Interestingly, only 9% of those we surveyed thought that they used somewhat or a lot more energy than others in their community. Now, if you do the math, it's unlikely that 9% of people, that only 9% of people are in fact doing or using more energy than others in their community. And on to this partisanship issue, which I think would be interesting for our discussion. Of all the demographic variables we collected, only partisanship was statistically significant in determining as a predictor. These splits may not be surprising, but on whether government should be extremely or very involved in finding solutions to the country's energy problems, Democrats, 79%, thought government should be extremely or very involved. 42% of Republicans thought government should be extremely or very involved. On whether they strongly or somewhat in favor of government incentives that will give money to consumers to help them purchase energy savings products, Democrats, 76%, were strongly or somewhat in favor. Republicans, 43%, were strongly or somewhat in favor. And then finally, when it comes to importing energy, a majority of Republicans at 65% viewed the need to import energy as driven by a supply issue. We don't have enough energy. Whereas the majority of Democrats perceived wasting energy was the reason that we need to import more energy. So that was 51% of Democrats and 65% of Republicans. And that's an interesting split. You see the supply side on the Republican side, and you see a behavior or choice response on the Democrat side. We have a bunch of data that have as of yet not been coded. We asked, what does the phrase energy efficiency mean to you? And this was an open-ended response. And in the survey business, open-ended responses are difficult to code and present rigorously. So we are trying to do that. I will say, in a totally unscientific way, these answers vary wildly between people who respond simply in sort of a tautological way that energy efficiency means doing more with less, so redefining the word efficiency. There have been people who have indicated a cynicism or skepticism. We've seen responses saying, I think it's a scam, or this is a waste of time and money. So kind of a knee-jerk opposition to energy efficiency. They think they're being duped somehow. And this was not a large percentage, but noticeable enough. And then of interest to you guys, I think, the environment was a small driver in my, again, caveated, unscientific reading of this. The environment was not a very prevalent theme when people were asked, what does energy savings or energy efficiency mean to you? So the areas that some might hypothesize would be drivers of people's opinion, either there is a national security component, I save energy, we need less, therefore we don't need a forward military projection, et cetera. Or I save energy, therefore there's less carbon in the air. Those things were less obviously present in the data. And again, this is my read on this. This is not rigorously analyzed as of yet. I know Trevor would want me to say that. And that is all I have. I think there's lots more in the data. If there are specific questions, I'm happy to, you know, to take those. Trevor and I can try to answer as best we can. And thank you for your attention.
Okay, John, why don't you give us a little bit about understanding public opinion on environmental issues. And John has some handouts up here, too, so that we can...
You may or may not find those helpful.
Okay. Hey. Wow. You have to get close. So first of all, I'm going to apologize for my voice cracking like a 14-year-old boy's. This is West Texas. I live here, and it's cotton season, so allergies are awful. But it's a wonderful place, and we're glad you're here. So, all right, my name's John Gerlach. I am a I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Texas Tech. And environmental issues are of interest to me from a research perspective. And also from a teaching perspective. So in academia, we take things on a little bit differently from the standpoint of everything has to have a theoretical driver. There has to be a reason why people respond to these polls in the manners in which they do. So my colleague and I, Cindy Rugeley, who's also at Texas Tech, she's been there a couple years longer than I have, we took on this study of what drives environmental public opinion. Now, this has been done. This has been done. However, we found a little bit of a difference in what's already out there on the subject and the way that we kind of wanted to approach it. So, first and foremost, most environmental public opinion driver studies would take a look at one environmental concern or opinion on the environment. As a general sort of question. If I walked up to you and asked, what do you think about the environment? Well, a whole lot of different issues and dimensions fall underneath the umbrella category of the environment. So we kind of wanted to start parsing out, you know, what makes up the environment, and we can all sit here and think. It's climate change, energy, wilderness protection, all these different dimensions, in even down to economics, environment versus jobs. So another thing that we wanted to do was to figure out why there's such a political divide on some of these dimensions. Now, we knew going into the survey that we were going to find that most people that leaned liberal or leaned Democrat or were very liberal, very Democrat, we're going to express support for climate change. It just, that's what you read. And vice versa, the other side, some skepticism on the conservative or Republican side. So we expected those results. The only thing is we don't understand why partisan attachment or partisan attitudes are so indicative of how someone believes on a dimension such as climate change and not real indicative of how somebody believes on wilderness protection. Now, maybe, you know, it sounds like different studies maybe find some different results, and that's fine. But what we did is we decided that we were going to take a Downsian approach. Anthony Downs, 1957, a seminal work that basically said that when an issue has high information costs, so when it's difficult to form an opinion, then an individual will take what's known as a mental shortcut, or it's called heuristic processing. An individual will turn to heuristic cues, such as something he or she knows, to basically tell the individual what to think, in a way. And I know that it sounds very cynical, but that's the theory behind it. So the theoretical hook to our paper And I passed around the handout. So you have the cover sheet of the paper and then a little tiny summary on the next two pages. The theoretical hook is that citizens are going to turn to these heuristic cues, things that they know, such as political affiliation, and then we thought the media, to inform their opinions on complex environmental issues. So what we did is we took on a, we could have run these data, we could have asked more questions actually and built a better data set, and it's a definite limitation of this study and an area for future research. What we did is we tried to look at public opinion on climate change, public opinion on the environment versus jobs, and opinion on general wilderness protection. And so our hypotheses and the, sort of the theory behind this is that public opinion on climate change is going to be significantly impacted by political affiliation because people view their parties, Democrats, Republicans, whatever, as a way to lower their information costs. Now think about it. Climate change is an extremely scientifically sophisticated issue. And most individuals don't understand every single little scientific dimension that goes into climate projection models. And because that's the case, our assertion is that people turn to party affiliation and political ideology to sort of steer their opinion on the issue. Now, we hypothesize that on the environment versus jobs, that this is sort of a middle ground dimension with regard to complexity. People can identify with job loss and economics because it hits us in the wallet. However, people also trust and turn to economic data, economic indicators such as unemployment rates in their respective states, or perceptions of the national economy. So what we said is that, hey, we're going to see sort of some demographics that are going to tell us how people believe on the environment versus jobs, but we're also going to see a few examples of heuristic processing or turning to known sources for information. Now, with regard to the wilderness protection variable, our hypothesis is that people understand wilderness protection. Whether you live in New York City and wilderness to you is Central Park, or whether you live here in West Texas and wilderness to you is everywhere around you, it feels like. By the way, there's no going outside of Lubbock, so don't even try it. You'll get lost out there. Anyway, so wilderness protection is something that we know. And the thing about it is there are several scholars have kind of pointed to the fact that, and John Zoller is probably chief among them, that when there's an issue that hits us closer to home, it is much easier for us to process information and make an immediate determination on where we stand. So wilderness protection, I grew up in the state of West Virginia. It hits me close to home. I'm all about wilderness protection, sure. That's all West Virginia has. So anyway, that's the basis of our study. And what we did is we determined that we were going to try to buy into the Cooperative Congressional Election Survey, which is quite expensive, but we've got a great department at Texas Tech. And they decided this was a go. So what we did is once we whittled it down for all sorts of statistical allowances. We have an N of 834, which is really not enough. I mean, it's a nationwide sample of 834 individuals. We had hoped to be much higher. Again, another limitation of the study, but limitations lead to future research. So what we did is we asked questions on climate change skepticism or support. We asked a question on how do you view the environment versus jobs? Would you rather protect the environment at the cost of jobs, vice versa, or somewhere in between? And then we asked about level of interest in wilderness protection. And what we found is pretty much what we thought we'd find. On the issue of climate change, demographic variables such as race, gender, income, age, not so much the predictors that we thought of climate change opinion. And this was kind of going against a lot of the literature that's already out there, and we kind of realized that and sort of rolled the dice on it. But what we did find is that political affiliation is strongly indicative here. This is the driver for understanding public opinion on climate change. And this is kind of the no-duh part. If you're a liberal, you tend to be a little bit more accepting of climate change. If you're conservative, you tend, and this is, I'm not trying to generalize, to be a little bit more skeptical, and that's what we found. We kind of found some middle-of-the-road stuff on the environment versus jobs, and we found that really people turn to the heuristic cue of mainly state unemployment rate to determine whether or not they supported the environment over job savings, job creation. We also found, though, that political affiliation is a strong indicator of public opinion on environment versus jobs. We didn't find as many demographic variables to be indicative of this form of public opinion on this dimension than we thought. But where we found the demographics to come into play is exactly where we thought, and that was on wilderness protection. Basically, we found that the older somebody gets, the more interested they become in wilderness protection. We also found a gender divide, which kind of surprised us. In our study, at least, females tended to support wilderness protection over and above males. This is slight. This is basically, I don't have the probabilities in front of me, but it was close with regard to if you're a female, you have a higher probability of being very interested in wilderness protection. So just briefly to wrap up, some implications of this. First of all, theoretically, which is what we always have to talk about in academia, but I'm not going to bore you with it. Heuristic processing is a big thing, and it's a big theoretical topic in social science research. And we applied it to kind of drawing some different environmental dimensions out, and we were fortunate to do it successfully. But practically, and this is what is probably most important, practically, public opinion and policy making, while they're not exactly aligned, are very highly associated. Presidents, and there's a lot of literature out there on presidents such as Reagan and Nixon being quite interested, if not privately quite interested, within the confines of the Oval Office, in public opinion and quite concerned. So, V.O. Key in his 1961 work said that public opinion matters in policymaking. So our thought is that understanding public opinion and who forms this public opinion and why maybe matters even more. So there's a whole lot more to be done with this project. You have the citation for the paper and a little bit of a summary. And I don't know, it's sort of like the last line in the, it's such a cliche, but I don't know why we wrote that. But, it's peeling back the proverbial onion. It's like, oh, my goodness. But, yeah, we let that go, so sorry. Just read to the last paragraph and quit. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Joyce, I just want to sort of start the conversation off here. But Joyce, shortly after your report came out, the National Wildlife Organization released a survey that showed anglers and fishermen, which are largely conservative, tend to believe in climate change and want to protect the environment or the wildlife conservation efforts more so than other Republicans. And I guess what I'd like to ask you is, how is this data in your survey used locally, statewide, or even federally to promote policies that protect the environment, and politically?
The people that hunt and fish are they're kind of a traditional conservative group. I mean, it's a more rural activity, that's part of the decline as we become more urban. So that said, they're also very tied to the land and extremely conservation-oriented. They'll often say that sportsmen are the first conservationists because they are out there among them. So I think that that plays into what you're talking about, is that this particular group, about 9% of Americans that hunt, 11 that fish, they are more tied and they're seeing what's happening out there, I think, a little more. That they tend to be Republican or Democrat, I can't speak to that because we don't. But this type of research that's done that shows the economic impact, I mean, that is incredibly important to congressional interests, the Sportsmen's Caucus, and others who do the national policymaking, as well as state fish and game agencies, state natural resource agencies, who see these trends and realize their constituents are growing in numbers and they need to be more responsive. So when their constituents are a little bit more in favor and understand climate change, I think they push more for those issues. That's the base of how the policy comes in that world. It comes sort of from the bottom up, as game is managed by state resource agencies. So management of those resources is fairly local, as opposed to national policy.
Okay, thank you. Matt, part of your study focused, one of the questions focused on blame. And I was wondering if you could talk about that before we get into the general survey discussion here.
Sure. The question that you're talking about is, who do Americans blame for the energy problems in the United States? And I'm not sure. I have a slide on this. But the breakdown, again, was driven by partisanship, and the choices of what or who to blame were, if you give me 2 seconds, I can pull it up here real quick and get you a better answer.
Okay, why don't we have that, actually? Okay.
The U.S. public accepts some responsibility for the country's energy problems, but most actually place responsibility with the energy industry, and they would prefer that government be involved in some way to help find a solution. And so the question we asked was, do you think each of the following statements is a major reason, minor reason, or not a reason at all for this country's energy problems? For instance, people use a lot of energy and they are not willing to reduce that demand. 64% thought that was a major reason. 27% thought that was a minor reason. Going all the way down, the energy industry does not supply enough energy to meet the demands of the people. 36% thought this was a major reason. 37 thought it was a minor reason. And 24 thought it was not a reason at all. So we have a gamut, really, of usage and inability or unwillingness to reduce usage, all the way down to the supply side. We also have statements about, you know, people don't do enough to support clean energy sources like wind and solar. 59% thought that was a major reason, 29% minor, and 10% not at all. So does that get a little bit to the,
yeah,
the breakdown here?
Okay. And I guess what I'd like to do is to kick the conversation off is, you know, over in just in the last this last week, we've had two surveys come out, one from Yale Center on Climate Change and Pew Research, that it shows the number of public opinion about climate change going up to levels that we haven't seen in, 4 or 5 years. And this is largely, I'm sure, because of the hot summer and the drought and the wildfires that we've experienced over this these last several months. And then there was there was even a study that showed that the Keystone Pipeline has more public support than I expected to see in the study. So as journalists, how do we deal with this information and this unending stream of surveys and polls that are coming out on a variety of issues? And I'm hoping Trevor can provide a little insight on this.
Sure. The question you asked is actually what used to be my job, is to try and help the AP sort through all of this. For 8 years, I was director of polling at the AP, and I was the polling editor for the AP, and it was my job to make editorial judgments about how we reported on surveys. And, I mean, it's true. Increasingly, we see more and more surveys coming out from all kinds of different sources telling us apparently contradictory things about all kinds of different issues. And it does become a really difficult task to sort out which information we want to believe and which one information we don't, and draw meaning from it. So there's a few things that I always say to journalists when in analyzing poll data is, first of all, just because it says it's scientific doesn't mean that you have to believe it. There's a whole range of quality issues in polling. There's motivations of the people who sponsor the research. Some people just know what they're doing. Some people don't know what they're doing. But there's also just a range of approaches and techniques, and people can only answer the questions that they're specifically asked in the survey. And often there's a big leap between what people hear in a survey question and what gets written up in a press release that comes out of a survey report. So I always say to journalists to use your healthy skepticism in looking at polling data. It's the best tool that you have, because just because there are smart sounding data coming out doesn't mean that you should take it for face value. What we increasingly try to do, and one of the reasons why I have my job now at NMRC in partnership with the AP, is to try to take a much more smarter look at public opinion, and really, really try to derive meaning from it. So much of the polls that you see are just snapshots and horse race kind of coverage of what does the public think today. And not nearly enough effort is spent at in-depth analysis to understand the meaning of the survey data, the root causes of those opinions. And so I encourage you to look for those studies that try and do that. And there are independent sources out there, people like NRC, the Pew Research Center. Those people are really trying to do that work, and I encourage you to pay a lot of attention to what they're doing.
Well, a lot of surveys and polls show that the public does care about the environment. Sometimes they place it at a different level depending on what else is going on in the country, whether it's we're at war or the economic situation. But what, you know, from all these surveys we see it's split pretty much evenly down. How do, you know, there are even polls that I think John Kosnick from Stanford has routinely shown that people want their lawmakers to address environmental issues and to come out one way or the other on environmental issues. Are we, as journalists, as environmental journalists, and we're reporting on energy and these other issues, are we beating our head against the wall here, trying to explain these complex issues if all they're going to do is cave to whatever political affiliation they have? So maybe I'll, you know, whoever wants to chime in here.
I fear that the answer I want to give is not going to be real popular. Wow. I guess my thought on it is that it is an information cost scenario where, and it's sort of a vicious cycle, really. I mean, it's, you know, there was a time when all of this first became very politicized, and there was a reason for that, certainly. But now, because it's politicized, kids grow up identifying largely with the political parties of their families, their parents, or guardians. And my opinion is, and you can certainly disagree, that you're not beating your heads against the wall. I'm not saying that, but it is a difficult, it's like turning a battleship when it comes to getting a college student, and I'll speak to that, to think critically about an issue, to think analytically. And it's a thing where people, you know, students come into my classes and they have preconceived notions. And I don't know what the answer is there for as far as the fit between environmental journalists and being able to reach especially the younger sector of our society. Because college students, in my experience, don't understand climate change. And they don't seem to have a real interest in understanding it. So I guess in that sense, environmental journalists are going to be quite important to them because they're going to read what you write and listen to what you say. And they're going to look to their parents' political parties or maybe even their own. I mean, it's not without outside the realm of possibility that somebody goes out and leaves a Republican household and becomes a staunch Democrat. But they're going to seek ways to lower information costs and get around what is known as their bounded rationality or their limited information. Now, wouldn't you prefer, I guess, if everybody sought out and formed their own opinions? But that's not really the society in which we live. And I'll just shut up now and let them say something about this.
Trevor?
Well, to me, the fact that belief in climate change in the survey is highly correlated with actual temperatures in the environment is actually an encouraging sign, because this is a very complicated issue, and it's also one of the issues that has become most politicized. So people are being bombarded with completely different perspectives, very, very confusing messages that completely contradict each other coming from one side or another. And the fact that people actually do change their opinions based on information that they themselves observe, to me, says that people are out there looking for, well, what is the truth? And if they react when things get hotter and they start to feel that, well, maybe there is something to this global warming thing. To me, that's a sign that people are desperate for real independent information on this issue and are trying to understand it.
So with that encouraging comment, I'm going to have a slightly discouraging comment. When we asked the trusted source question, who do Americans trust for energy savings information, I mentioned that local utilities were the only source that a majority trusted or very much or completely. The lowest two ratings were for TV news or newspapers and online websites. So at 21% completely or very much trust TV news or newspapers, I think this is just a personal observation. It speaks to a larger skepticism of mainstream media or the slanted nature of cable news, et cetera. And that's just my extrapolation. But just because only 21% completely or very much trust you guys, I don't think that's a reason to stop trying. So I'm sorry, that was my discouraging comment.
And mine's neither encouraging or discouraging. Mine is more of a resource to check the numbers type of survey. I mean, it's telling you where in numbers of dollars. But I did notice, and these are preliminary results, what will happen is other groups will take this information and analyze it for other aspects, such as you're talking about surveys come out, they use this as their base resource. But I did notice that when this comes out and it's shown that hunters have increased 9%, suddenly I did see Ryan in front with a big deer in front of him and showing his hunting. He is making that connection to these people. And because hunting especially is gun, so people who are pro-gun, suddenly they're playing to this data. I'm just saying they're using the data. The analysis isn't there, but they're saying, oh, wait a second, this is an up trend. I need to look like I'm one of these people.
Right.
And I think that's how it plays out. It's not scientific survey because we're not there yet, and it'll take some months to get there. And the state reports that will be coming out talking about individual states, they don't even start to come out till December. So that's really too late. But this does show that of that conservative group, which are hunters, I think of hunters especially, it's like a 55-year-old white male. That is the demographic. So if that's who you're playing to for your votes, you want to be out there with your big deer head showing that you, too, use guns and you're out a man of the land. And I see that as a factor.
Okay. All right, thank you. Let's have some questions from the audience now, okay?
So the website is apnorc.org, and you can download top-line results, the full report. I don't think we have the question. The questionnaire is in the top-line results. So, and I'd be happy to send you any additional materials that the presentation.
It was actually quite consistent with other sort of trust and institution surveys that are out there, and it's really remarkable in the past decade in particular how much generally people's trust in institutions of all sorts has declined, from everything from the church to the scientific community to journalism to governments. And for some reason, the public utility companies maintain a higher level of trust than other sorts of institutions. And why that is, we're not really sure, but probably it's because public utilities, they have to deliver a basic product, otherwise people die, and so the extent of people's experience with their utilities is generally pretty positive. So that's.
I'd have to say, unless you live in D.C. and then you have Pepco, and then your experience is not positive.
Yeah, there are a few other utilities.
Yeah, Pepco is actually, not to dog on Pepco, but I'm going to. They were ranked as, I think, the most hated company in the United States ahead of, Philip Morris or whatever. The actual wording of the question is, when you get information about ways to save energy from blank, how much do you trust the information they provide? What's ironic about this is that although government is not trusted very much at all, the information on energy savings programs delivered by the utility are largely government-sponsored programs.
Right.
So the Department of Energy, through the Recovery Act, et cetera, is delivering the information they want to deliver, but the utilities are getting the credit when it comes to reliability of their information, credibility of their information.
Right, because all the energy efficiency incentives that typically come through your local utility, and they're either state or federal funded. So, gentleman back here in the back. I don't know who was here at the plenary yesterday morning, what Catherine Hayhoe was saying about just, you know, the individual nature of Americans and the way, you know, that they don't want the government interfering in their lives in any way. But it's also, as we all know, the climate story is really hard to tell. And unless you actually see changes, I mean, after Katrina, there was a real jump in the number of individuals who believed, you know, that climate was related to that, even though it couldn't be directly linked to it. But I think it's, you know, I think that as journalists, one of the things that we do need to do is bring these climate stories, these environmental stories, always, like a toxic spill or, you know, any of these types of, the loss of a wildlife preserve or any of these environmental issues. These are how we can bring these stories to our publics and make them important to them, make them see that, you know, invite them to see the changes and what are the dangers ahead. So, you know, in fact, it's kind of, you know, we can open their eyes to these, as well as open their eyes to help them learn ways to save energy instead of just depending on their utility to company to help them buy, you know, compact fluorescent bulbs. Okay, back here. Okay. Okay, the question is does the type of media that you listen to have a different impact then?
Yeah, that's something that we wish we would have parsed out with regard to what what radio shows are you listening to? The only thing I can say that I know definitively is that the majority of those that commented that they had listened to a radio show, TV news, in the past 24 hours were conservative. So the only identified with a conservative ideology. So the only thing I can really say is that I'm sitting in my office imagining that most people that answered that question in that manner, instead of listening to NPR, listen to Rush Limbaugh. So that's an area that we could take this study, and we really needed to. Basically, our questions were limited on the Congressional Election Survey, and it's a limitation of the paper and an area that we need to go down in the future.
Okay, another question. Okay, how best to turn the ship of political opinion? Okay, best
sure.
ways.
Well, the gentleman in the back corner pointed out that wouldn't it be great if we taught climate change on the university level? And yeah, that's to me that's a utopian. That's the wonderful ideal setting. If every freshman that came to Texas Tech University were required to know something about climate change or take a class. The problem is that if you scroll through Texas Tech University's undergraduate curriculum, find a spot. There are arts people, music people, people wanting more physical education. The problem seems to be that in the general education curriculum, not only at Texas Tech, but other state universities especially, that it's difficult to educate on climate change. If you make an elective, nobody wants to take it. And the sad thing is people shy away from science and math these days. And we've seen that movement in middle schools, high schools. So, how do you turn the ship? I think that it probably comes down to reaching the students that you can reach and doing it well. You mentioned Dr. Hayhoe being here yesterday. She's a tremendous asset for Texas Tech with regard to reaching our graduate students and even undergraduates. But there aren't too many Dr. Hayhoes out there.
Well, our role here is really not to be trying to steer any ships. What we're trying to do is understand how opinions work in this issue. But I will say that all of our data shows that people are very much interested in these issues and they care a lot about them, even in the context of the Great Recession, that people's interest and concerns about energy and environmental issues didn't decline that much. And people are interested and concerned and do want information about this. So the work that all of you are doing is just so important, and I encourage you to continue it. So.
Get back here. Well, this goes back, this is about education, young college students and climate change.
But. Yeah, no, I'll briefly say that, yes, that's a wonderful idea, and that's something that I'll say I don't teach climate change at Texas Tech. I teach political science courses, general policy courses, and nonprofit management courses. So, what you're saying, though, I have seen with my own eyes in Dr. Hayhoe's graduate courses. Now, what we need is with her 2-2 teaching load to have more people like her on staff at state universities that will teach undergraduate courses in this subject matter. Because certainly you can reach undergrads with all kinds of, just do a light show and they're going to be awake. So that's a great point. It's just a matter of we don't have enough faculty that teach us on the undergraduate level.
Okay, I'm going to go with the journalist first and then I'm going to come back to you. Okay. Question, I'm supposed to repeat the question, so I'm a little late. It's about, was there any data on gender, gender breakdown on the Fish and Wildlife Service? So, all right. Next question is about
that. Wildlife watching, which I didn't explain, which would have been nice to follow up on your question. In the wildlife watching, it's Wildlife Associated Recreation, they have a very, very strong definition. This doesn't mean you put out bird feeders in your backyard. This is that you took a trip, that you did some activity that took you to specifically do that, that is an activity that you went off to do that you had an economic impact. So if you went to state parks and with photography or whatever, that type is what they're talking about, wildlife associated recreation. This is not just you like birds and feathered things. It is that you spent money, that was your destination, that was your activity, and I did not make that clear.
But Joyce, it did include sort of backyard watching data too, didn't it? Or local, more local, whether you travel or not.
Right, but yeah. It is that you, and maybe you went to a local park.
Right, okay.
But it isn't that what you did outside your window. Not, it's just not an affirmation of do you like outdoorsy things. It, you had to have done an activity geared towards that, whether it was local or whatever.
Okay. All right, this question back here.
We weren't able to break the data down by region, so I'm afraid I don't have an answer for you on that.
I think Joyce is the Fish and Wildlife Service is broken down by region. So,
it is, but yeah. Again, it's participation rates and economics, so it doesn't really get to environmental type questions in environmentally related activities.
Trevor, do you have any insight on that?
Certainly people have looked at that. I'm not an expert myself on that divide, but one of the interesting regional things that we found going on with our data, to the extent that we could only look at the very biggest census regions, you know, north, northeast, south, Midwest, west, was that there were regional differences, but when we took into account party identification, they almost all went away. So to the extent that yeah. people in the South felt differently than people in the Northeast, it was mostly because of their political backgrounds rather than anything about anything going on in that region. So,
okay. Any other questions? Why, if there are so many wildlife watchers, why is National Audubon membership so low? Is that right? Joyce? I don't know if you can answer that.
I really don't have a clue, but it isn't just bird watching. And in this one, I was rather surprised that activity actually only grew by 2%, where hunting and fishing had grown by, you know, double digits. And I have no idea, maybe more marketing, but many of those hunting groups, in fact, are going up, like Turkey Federation and Ducks Unlimited. So I don't know about Audubon. Sorry.
I mean, I don't study this data a bit, but I think that it goes back to what John's study looks at too, is what is the closest information to you, and also the trust issue. Because if you're reading, and it depends on whether you believe what you read in the newspaper or whatever media you watch, but then if you're getting conflicting information from another, you know, cable news channel or radio program, then I think it's like this political affiliation. It just sort of cancels it out. So it's kind of hard to you know, all we can do is just report the facts, you know, and try to reach out and keep it going. There is a lot of effort there. Bud Ward, who's with SEJ, has worked with these meteorological groups to help educate that group about climate science. And well, I guess, you know, I think this is a topic we're going to pick up on a larger scale in the luncheon plenary. So I encourage you all to be there too. If we don't have any more discussion, are we ready to go? Thank you for coming.